We're learning about Delta 8 THC, a new cannabinoid on the rise. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. It's been called a marijuana cousin or weed light. It's derived from hemp plants. Some states like Michigan have new laws on the books for this drug that is very similar to Delta 9 THC, the primary active ingredient of marijuana. So what questions do you have about THC derivatives in hemp products? What about the effects of Delta 8? It's 800-642-1234. Amy Miles is Director of Forensic Toxicology at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene. Amy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, break this down for us. Give us a fuller sense of what Delta 8 THC is.
Sure. Delta 8 is derived from CBD or hemp, and when the Farm Bill Act in 2018 was revamped, it sort of created this legal loophole that a lot of us, including myself, sometimes have to question whether or not Delta 8 is in fact legal or illegal. What we do know about it from a scientific standpoint is that we don't know much. We really haven't studied Delta 8 very well, and we know that it's similar to Delta 9 because it's kind of like a chemical cousin, but it doesn't have the same binding affinity to the receptors as Delta 9 does. So that's pretty much the extent of what we know. There are studies that are going on right now to better understand it, but at this point, we really are scratching our heads a bit about, is it as impairing as Delta 9 or what we would consider regular marijuana? And does it have any harmful effects? We just don't know for sure.
What is the 8 in Delta 8? Is that like the molecule itself?
Yeah. So Delta 8 and Delta 9 are really similar. Again, they're like cousins to each other. The 8 and the 9 are just different because they have what we call a double bond that's located on different sets of chains of carbon atoms. So basically, they are structurally really similar, but they just have, if you think of like you've got your five fingers on your hand and you have your thumb in one spot and your pinky in the other, and it's always that way, maybe on Delta 8, the thumb is on the opposite side of the pinky or something to that extent. So it's really similar, and that's why we know a little bit about it, but not enough to provide guidance or understanding to people to know how it will affect them.
And Delta 8 is psychoactive. It produces a high sensation, right?
That, again, is a little unclear. If you think about drugs, any drug, they all bind to what we call receptors in your body. And so for cannabis or THC, Delta 9 THC, it binds to really specific receptors. So kind of like in the winter, you put your beanie cap on your head and it fits really well and it does what you need it to do. It covers your ears, keeps your head warm. Delta 8 also is the same way. It does bind to that same receptor. So again, thinking of that beanie or that cap in the winter, but it doesn't quite fit the same. And so because it's not quite covering that whole receptor or that beanie isn't covering your whole head, we know it's not offering the same effects, but we just don't know the full extent.
I just love your analogies. They just really, they really help so much, Amy. Let me introduce you. Amy Miles is Director of Forensic Toxicology at the State Laboratory of Hygiene. She's explaining Delta 8 THC, a hemp-derived cannabinoid that is legally permitted through the latest farm bill. Taking your questions, you can join in. What questions do you have about THC derivatives in CBD or in hemp products? What do you want to know? 800-642-1234. So, Amy, Delta 8 is not CBD. Can you explain there the difference?
Yeah, they're, again, they're similar. So CBD often is extracted from the hemp plant, and then it's modified in a bunch of different chemical reactions to generate or create the Delta 8. So sort of like Delta 9, they're related and they're cousins. The big difference, though, between CBD and Delta 8 are CBD really, you know, again, going back to that beanie example, CBD is really more like your earmuffs, or maybe it's those crummy scarves that you kind of put around your head to cover your ears. So it just doesn't have nearly the same effect as we know Delta 9 does. And then again, you know, we're kind of questioning Delta 8.
So what regulations exist in Wisconsin over Delta 8 or products that advertise having Delta 8?
There are a number of municipalities throughout the state that are working to prohibit the purchase in people under the age of 18 and some of those other types of scenarios. We have had reports from law enforcement that they're pulling people over for impaired driving, and people look to be impaired and they have Delta 8 products. And then when the sample is sent to us to do the testing, we are seeing Delta 8, but we're also seeing Delta 9. So whether those people consumed marijuana in addition to taking the Delta 8 product, or if the illicit marijuana is in the Delta 8 product, we don't know because we don't actually get the products. We just test the biological samples we get.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, is there a problem with products being sold and marketed as Delta 8 and not actually being pure Delta 8 and having these trace cannabinoids in them?
Definitely. And this is just like what we talked about the last time I was with you and your show was, you know, none of these products are regulated by anyone. So pretty much anything can be in them. And I was speaking with some law enforcement that said they had the plant material that they had that was labeled as Delta 8 tested. And when I asked for the scope of testing or, you know, how many different drugs does that lab test for, they really were only looking for marijuana and Delta 8 and nothing else. Hmm. And when we look at our testing here at the laboratory, again, we're finding all sorts of other things in those samples in addition to that Delta 8. So whether the individual is taking those other things or the product they bought had them in there, we don't know. And that's why it's, we just want to make sure from a public health standpoint that we're just cautioning people that, you know, if you purchase these products while they are legal in Wisconsin, you really don't know what you're buying and just be very, very careful.
So your toxicology report might be this like chemical soup, if you will.
Yes, we often are referred to as Greek mythologists in a way because we report these drugs and people, it's Greek to them, they don't understand it. So we do get a lot of phone calls from just individuals trying to understand the report that we sent and how could there be these other compounds in there when they only took that over-the-counter product.
Do you have any sense in how Delta 8 is being ingested?
It depends. It's a lot like marijuana. A lot of what we are hearing from people are they are either edible product, so like a gummy bear or a cookie or something like that. We've heard of people smoking it just like you would marijuana. So it really does kind of trend right along with what you would expect with marijuana.
There's another isomer, Delta 10 THC. So what then is Delta 10?
So Delta 10 is a lot like the 8 beanie cap in that we know it doesn't bind as well as Delta 9 to our receptors. But here again, it has not been researched as extensively as Delta 9, so we really don't know much about it.
I feel like we're at this kind of experimental experimental chemistry lab.
It does feel that way, and that's why it's a little alarming from the public health side of it with what we do that, you know, a lot of our testing is to support law enforcement and the testing that they need, but it's also to take everything in as a holistic view and see what is happening out there in the population and what are the negative effects to potential public health issues. So we really do try to look at all of our testing as more than just we're supporting law enforcement, but we really are looking at this as a public health issue because, you know, buyers don't always know what they're buying or what they're consuming, and we try to do the best we can to educate.
Amy Miles is Forensic Toxicology Director at the State Hygiene Lab. What do you want to know about the safety of Delta 8? Do you think the drug should be legal? Do you work in law enforcement? What do you think people should know about marijuana derivatives? What are you seeing out there? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Amy Miles here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about toxicology analysis, evaluating the drugs in a person's system, and Delta 8, a hemp derivative that's been called marijuana light. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We have Amy Miles, the toxicology section director at the State Lab of Hygiene, which receives about 20,000 specimens, by the way, each year for alcohol, drug testing, or both. Have you tested positive for illegal marijuana use after using a CBD or hemp product? Share your experience with us. What concerns do you have about an unregulated chemical? Join in 800-642-1234. Amy is with us for about 10 more minutes. So, Amy, after neighboring states like Michigan and Illinois legalized marijuana, how much has your testing caseload changed?
That's actually a great question. We weren't entirely sure if it would affect our testing at all in terms of numbers. And really, both Illinois and Michigan was, I think, December of 2019, and then Illinois was early in 2020. You know, initially, we didn't really think we saw a difference, but we also had COVID last year, which mm-hmm. changed things quite a bit. Now, when we're looking at all of 2020, marijuana testing versus where we are right now so far in this year, we are set right now to eclipse almost double the testing that we did last year. So the numbers that I'm looking at as of today, we've almost reached the total of what we did all of last year. So we are definitely seeing an increase in our THC casework.
Is there a backlog?
Unfortunately, yes. You know, you try to prepare for everything. And like I said, COVID was one of those things that really none of us were prepared for, but we were here business as usual and did our best to keep chipping away at the samples that came in. But we just became very overwhelmed. So right now we probably have about 1,800 cases in backlog just for THC testing because we simply can't keep up.
Let's bring in a call now. Billy is joining us from Adams. Billy, hi. What is your question?
I was just wondering what the health and risk factors are with this Delta 8 and with the chemicals that are put into them.
Yeah, the health effects. What do you know, Amy?
That's actually such a great question, Billy, and it's really insightful, and I'm glad you're asking it. I think a lot of people just don't really think about that because we're so used to having marijuana just around for decades. Again, we don't know enough about Delta 8 to really say. There is a potential to have cross-reactivity or cross-reactions with other medications that you're taking, whether they're just maybe a vitamin, an over-the-counter, or prescription. And then if there are other things that are in these products, that causes even a greater risk because usually the things that are also in these products, such as synthetic cannabinoids, are things that are, again, not by prescription. They're not legal and very understudied. So we know quite a bit about synthetic cannabinoids to this point, but not enough to know more specifics about how it could react in your body with certain other drugs. So it really is a risk, and we just want people to be careful when they think about purchasing any products anywhere.
Let's go to Missy now in Milwaukee. Hi, Missy. What is on your mind?
Hi. I am wondering about kind of the subculture in Milwaukee and maybe like a placebo effect. I know that a lot of people who have perceived CBD to have a high, and I'm just kind of wondering how much of that has been studied in the case about how much of that might be psychological.
That's actually also a very good question, Missy. And that's something scientists think about all the time is that placebo effect. And you're right. It is entirely possible that someone is actually given something that's not going to be psychoactive or cause any sort of impairment, but they're going to feel like they are, or they're going to believe that they have some sort of reaction or impairment to it. And that's very real. Again, we look at that. The placebo effect is a very well-studied and understood phenomenon throughout science. So you're hitting the nail right on the head with that question.
We're talking with Amy Miles, Director of Forensic Toxicology at the State Laboratory of Hygiene, as we look at cannabis products synthesized from CBD, Delta 8 in particular, and what they mean for health. 800-642-1234. You know, Amy, more than a dozen states have banned Delta 8 THC and others are developing rules right now. Are regulators, do you think their regulators are behind on this one?
To a certain extent, they are, and a little of that is just the science isn't there either. You know, you can't blame them for not regulating something that we really hadn't studied and we didn't really educate anyone on. So I think it's just a twofold where, from a scientific standpoint, we really hadn't been giving Delta 8 or Delta 10 the attention we probably should have over the years just to better study it and understand it. And so when people want to make any kind of laws or regulations banning it or just at least limiting its resource, you know, we can't really give them a whole lot of guidance. And we're seeing it come up in a lot of different ways in a lot of different places, which also is really confusing when people ask us just general blanket questions about the legality of these drugs. Because people are kind of doing it differently, we don't ever really know.
Mike now in Russ County. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about purity in general. It's not only the ultimate conformers or isomers of the THC molecule, but there's also all of the solvents and the precursors and starting materials these people have to use in order to manufacture the alternate forms. And, you know, these aren't quality labs. These are not pharmaceutical labs with a major pharmaceutical company doing, you know, very stringent quality procedures to clean up their final products. You know, these are fly-by-night designer drug labs. And, man, I would be just as much or more worried about some of those products than whether it's Delta 8, Delta 9, whatever.
The materials needed to make these reactions, Amy.
Right. He's absolutely correct. It can be really scary. You take CBD and you need to process it through to get it turned into a distillate. So in order to do that, you have to melt it down. You have to use acid as a reagent. And in some cases, we're hearing people are using battery acid. Then you have to neutralize it with an alkaline material, wash it. You know, there's a whole process that occurs and a manipulation that occurs chemically. And a lot of people are just turning to pretty basic but really caustic chemicals just to make this reaction occur. So he was absolutely right. The end product not only contains a drug that we just don't know a whole lot about, but it contains all sorts of other probably unintended additives to it just through that whole distillate process.
So what are you watching for here with Delta 8? What are you keeping an eye on?
We at the hygiene lab are tracking the Delta 8 cases. As we see them, we're just trying to monitor them and decide, you know, what do we do with them? As a laboratory, we're not even really sure. We can detect them. We can see them. It's a definite separation in our testing between Delta 8 and Delta 9. So when it's there, we know it. But we're just not entirely sure what to do with it. You know, from a public health standpoint, I feel like we should probably start collecting more information and just letting folks know. But then, you know, what do we do with that? We don't know. We don't know what the numbers mean. We don't know if it's there. Is it there because they took it, or is it there because it's a consequence of something else?
I wonder how much do your caseloads and your specimens translate to what is happening in communities, in Wisconsin communities around the state? Do you have any sense of that?
We have done a better job today than ever before of tracking more community level information from our data, because we understand, again, we're a little different than most crime labs or forensic labs because we are actually part of the public health lab. So our vision is more toward exactly what you said, looking at our data and trying to determine, are there community level actions that should occur or things that we should be watching for trends in different areas of the state. We do a lot with different groups within the Department of Health, the Wisconsin State Department of Health. They're called overdose fatality reviews. So those are throughout the state, different counties hold reviews of all their fatal overdoses. And we come in and talk to them about the drugs that we found, how common they are in their area, what are we seeing in trends and things like that. So we do try to go beyond just, you know, doing the testing in the lab, but also a lot of information and education and community level efforts.
And we saw drug overdoses surge across the country last year.
Yeah, it was, you know, even for us, it's sad to say, but we see them fairly often. But even over the last year, it's been tough. It's been, you know, we have a little bit of vicarious trauma here, I think, just looking at a lot of these cases, and we're reading the histories and seeing the impact on the families. It's been pretty devastating.
Amy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amy Miles, she is Director of Forensic Toxicology at the Wisconsin State Laboratory of Hygiene, as we've been looking at the impact of Delta 8. Ahead this hour, we discuss the global minimum corporate tax rate after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen voiced her support. How do you feel about nations coordinating on their corporate taxes? Do you support a 15% tax floor, if you will? Join in 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about Rib Mountain.
There's a rumor that Rib Mountain in central Wisconsin is an extinct volcano. It seems somewhat reasonable. You can see it from miles away, and there are volcanic rocks all over the city of Wausau. Well, it's not. It never was. And although it does have ties to ancient volcanoes, the star of Rib Mountain's story is a rock too tough to break. Liz Domes Harder brings us the story.
You could say Rib Mountain in central Wisconsin has stood the test of time. I'm not talking about its ski hill that has been open since 1937, nor the state park that's been there for almost a century. I'm talking about something much older.
The rock that makes up Rib Mountain is called quartzite. It's a very, very hard rock, one of the hardest on Earth, and it's estimated to be about 1.7 billion years old.
That's Scott Spoolman, a science writer who lives in Madison and literally wrote the book on Wisconsin's rocks called, well, Wisconsin Rocks.
That's 1,700 million or 17 million centuries old.
So this stuff lasts. But where did it come from? Mark Janowiak from New Glarus has wondered a lot about that.
You know, I'm a Wikipedia expert on Rib Mountain, so I learned, three things about it.
Janowiak and I both grew up near Rib Mountain and spent plenty of winters skiing its slopes. He sent in a few questions to Wisconsin about Rib Mountain, and they got me curious, too.
Is Rib Mountain volcanic in origin? How big was the, if it is, how big is the, like, the volcanic range?
There were four volcanoes in the Wausau area 1.8 billion years ago, explains Lisa Seward. She's a senior lecturer of geography and geology at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. But Rib Mountain wasn't one of those volcanoes. It was the hard rock underneath one of them.
Underneath volcanoes are magma chambers, and those magma chambers brought up a bunch of this super-duper hard rock that we call quartzite.
Spoolman explains where that came from.
It's originally sandstone. It's ancient sandstone, and it was deposited by ancient seas, and then it was eventually buried under other sediments and then mashed by continental collisions that caused unimaginable heat and pressure and metamorphosed that sandstone into the very hard rock called quartzite.
We can get a sense of how big the volcano was. In the footprint of one of those old volcanoes are three quartzite blobs: Hardwood Hill, Mosinee Hill, and of course, Rib Mountain.
Think of the size of Rib Mountain. That is a quartzite blob.
Keith Montgomery has some good analogies. He's a retired geography and geology professor who lives in Wausau.
You can think that the mountains that existed here would have been similar to Mount Rainier or Mount Baker, those kinds of mountains. So several thousand feet, maybe 10,000 feet above the local terrain.
For comparison, Rib Mountain is 650 feet above the local terrain. The mountain range that stretched across the upper Midwest and into Canada quickly eroded away. Spoolman explains.
There were no plants or animals, so everything was eroding almost as fast as it was growing.
Still, weathering was no match for Rib Mountain's quartzite. But what about glaciers? Janowiak had a question about that, too.
Because one thing I read is the glaciers kind of went around. It didn't go over the top. Or did it go over the top?
There's been four major glaciations in the last million years or so. And pretty likely that three of those four did cross over Rib Mountain.
The most recent glacier stopped short of the mountain. The other three before it might have scraped off some chunks. Lucky for those of us who enjoy the mountain, that quartzite is one tough rock.
WPR's Liz Domes-Harder brought us that story on Rib Mountain. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to a listener request that we discuss a global minimum tax rate. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, she announced earlier this month that a group of 132 nations now have agreed to a global minimum tax for the world's largest corporations. Do you think corporations pay too little or too much taxes in our country? Should they be punished for moving to countries with lower tax rates? It's 800-642-1234. Alexandra Reedhead is with the International Institute for Sustainable Development, headquartered in Winnipeg, Canada, and she leads its research on tax-based erosion and profit shifting in mining. Alexandra, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much for having me.
So all these countries, they agree to rewrite the rules for how countries tax corporate income. Why is this notable?
Well, it's notable because achieving a tentative global consensus on something like this has never been done before. So introducing a global minimum tax is a novel and important idea because the objective is really to stop the race to the bottom. So over the last 40 years, we've seen average corporate tax rates decline in every decade in every region. So back in 1980, corporate tax rates were around 40% around the world. Now in 2020, the average is 24%.
And why do they keep going lower? What is pushing them down?
I think many countries have seen tax competition or lowering their corporate tax rates as a way of attracting investment. And the idea is that investment brings jobs and growth, but actually it hasn't always amounted to that. And oftentimes we end up giving away tax revenue for uncertain benefits.
Do you know how much lost revenue that governments are failing to collect due to tax avoidance?
Yeah, it's huge. So tax havens collectively cost governments between $500 billion and $600 billion a year in lost corporate tax revenue.
What are the ramifications of that?
Well, I think the ramifications are that many countries are struggling to deliver basic social services. It's led to rising inequality in a number of countries where the rich pay very little by way of tax and the middle income group end up paying quite a lot. So we see a growth in inequality. Now with COVID, many countries are struggling to find the resources to be able to fund both the response to COVID but also the post-COVID recovery that will follow.
So as you look across the world, Alexandra, which countries have been, you know, quote unquote, winning this race to the bottom, winning this race for the lowest tax rate, if you will?
I think low tax countries or tax havens have probably been the key winners in this race. So countries that offer very low tax rates have managed to attract firms to relocate there, to take advantage of low tax rates. But that has, you know, created a whole number of negative externalities or spillover effects, if you like, for other countries that are losing tax revenue to those jurisdictions through corporate tax avoidance. So you set up in Luxembourg or the Bahamas, and then you have operations elsewhere, and you engage in corporate tax planning. So you shift profits out of high tax countries and transfer them to those low tax countries. And so those higher tax countries are losing out whilst those lower tax countries are winning, if you like.
And Barbados has the lowest corporate tax rate at 5.5%?
Yes. It's not alone. There are many other countries that get a run for its money. So certainly the era of tax competition and tax havens in particular has been a significant one. And now it looks like it might finally be coming to an end with a global minimum tax.
Is there a return on investment for these countries that are willing to go this low, to lower their corporate taxes? How do they benefit from luring companies or multinationals and, who will ultimately pay very little in taxes and yet still use all the resources?
Well, I think, here it really depends on which countries we're talking about. If we're talking about places like Barbados, then you'd say, well, some of these places don't have a lot else going on. I mean, obviously tourism is important, but they don't have a lot of other industry. And so for them, offering a low corporate tax rate is probably one of the, the best options that they have to try and attract investment into their country. And there will be some benefits from it. People have to set up offices, albeit, kind of makeshift letterbox offices, if you like. They have to employ some people. You might have some accountants, some lawyers relocating there in order to service those companies. So there certainly will be some benefits. And for those countries, they may not have very many options. I think, though, the issue is for perhaps less tax haven or some of those island nations, if you like, that have got fewer options, but other countries that are then forced to compete with them, where for them it's not necessarily as clear that offering tax incentives and foregoing tax revenue is a good decision. And as we see, repeatedly, politicians are saying, well, if we lower corporate tax rates, then we'll attract investment, and investment delivers jobs and growth. But actually, if many of these corporations are transferring their profits offshore to low tax countries or tax havens, then we're not necessarily seeing the benefit. And as we move into an age of automation and technology, we see less jobs. And so the benefits of having that investment in the first place, I think, become less obvious, and certainly the cost in terms of the tax revenue that's foregone become more obvious and more problematic, particularly in the era that we live in off the back of the global financial crisis and now COVID. Countries have agreed that tax competition has to stop. They can't afford to continue to forego these vital tax revenues to multinational companies. And it's ultimately multinational companies that are winning here. I mean, tax havens are also benefiting, but it's the multinationals that are the clear winners.
Well, let's go to Ivy now in Evansville with thoughts on the corporate tax rate. Ivy, hi.
Hi. I just think that paying taxes is the cost of doing business. My grandfather, who owned an engineering firm in the 50s and 60s, my brother and I discovered his taxes, and he paid nearly 50%. I believe that these corporations benefit from our infrastructure, the security around doing business. I mean, none of their trucks are hijacked off the road, and all the things that make it possible for them to function well in our country. And so they need to contribute. And to me, it's egregious that Exxon, with an economy larger than Rhode Island, pays no taxes in our country. Anyway, that's my opinion. My grandfather did pay almost 50%.
Ivy, thank you. Yeah, thank you for bringing that observation and the history there with your grandfather. Alexandra.
I mean, I couldn't agree more with Ivy. Absolute agreement. And I think that's right. I mean, tax rates haven't always been this low. In fact, tax rates have typically been much higher, as Ivy said. As I said, back in the 1980s, we're talking about a global average corporate tax rate of around 40%. And so what we've seen over this period is just this massive decline in corporate tax rates as countries scramble to try and attract investment. And where they've got to now at the end of that is, well, was that really worth it after all? And I think, you know, obviously there are some examples of where incentives have been effective at attracting investment, but they're often very limited, and they're kind of the opposite of that, where incentives have been deeply ineffective and deeply damaging and harmful are more common. So I agree that, companies have paid higher tax rates in the past and they can pay higher tax rates. It is a cost of doing business. And so it's really exciting to see that countries have agreed to come together around an issue as important as this.
And we're going to talk more about this plan as we discuss a global minimum tax on corporations and the so-called race to the bottom and what it means for world economies. Alexandra Reedhead, she's an analyst with the International Institute for Sustainable Development. Are you in favor of treaties that would create global standards for taxing corporations, or would you rather the U.S. avoid binding treaties? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Alexandra Reedhead here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing the prospects of a minimum global tax rate for multinationals. At their meeting in London last month, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen announced G7 finance ministers had made a commitment to a global minimum tax at a rate of at least 15%.
That global minimum tax would end the race to the bottom in corporate taxation and ensure fairness for the middle class and working people in the U.S. and around the world.
How would you like countries to cooperate? Is it possible? What ideas do you have for getting companies to pay their fair share in taxes? 800-642-1234. Alexandra Reedhead is the tax lead in the International Institute for Sustainable Development with us for about 8 more minutes. Alexandra, the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, is negotiating here, putting this plan together. What is this agency?
Well, the OECD is a global organization representing developed economies, essentially. So many of the developed economies participate in the OECD. The OECD provides policy advice and assistance on a huge range of matters, including tax.
And so how would they carry out this plan? How would it work across the world?
Right. So the OECD, as part of its mandate to work on taxation, has formed what is called the Inclusive Framework. And the Inclusive Framework is made up of 135 member countries. And that group has agreed at the political level to implement a global minimum tax. So whilst the OECD the OECD is just an organization, it represents a handful of countries worldwide. By forming this inclusive framework, they've broadened, expanded their mandate, and this is going to be key to implementing this proposal. But what they've agreed to is a global minimum tax on corporate profits. So this means that the global profits of a multinational corporation with an annual turnover of more than 750 million euros will be taxed at least at a minimum effective tax rate. So that tax rate is going to be calculated on a country-by-country basis, which means that each entity that's part of the multinational group must pay at least the globally agreed rate in each of the jurisdictions where they're based. So as you said, at this stage, the tax rate looks likely to be 15%, but the next meeting will take place in October, and we'll hear more then. What this means is if that one of the entities within that group pays less than the agreed rate of tax to its host country, then the home country where the parent is headquartered collects the difference between the subsidiary's effective tax rate and the global minimum tax. So there's nowhere to hide, right? So you're a multinational, you've got operations in a lot of different jurisdictions. In each of those places, you have to pay at least 15%. And if you don't pay, then the country where the multinational is headquartered has the right to collect the difference, to pick up what we call the top-up tax. So it effectively tries to eliminate tax competition.
So is it true that China and India want like carve-outs to protect preferred industries? What would be some exemptions to this minimum corporate tax?
Yes, so there have been discussions around carve-outs, and this is one of the challenges, I think, between now when this political agreement that's been reached in October and following in the following months in terms of agreeing the technical details. So a lot of countries have already started to lobby for carve-outs. For example, a carve-out has been agreed for the financial services sector. I think certain countries like France, for example, are lobbying to protect their research and development tax credits. So certainly we'll see now, over the next few months, countries start to come up and say, well, you know, what about this tax incentive that I have? I'd really like to keep that. Is there any way we could kind of protect that or carve it out of this deal so it's not included in the calculation of the minimum effective tax rate?
We're talking with Alexandra Reedhead, who works for the International Institute for Sustainable Development. Let's go to Jim now in Cedarburg. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you. How do nonprofits get taxed? We have these behemoth healthcare systems, at least in our area, who are nonprofits.
Alexandra, what would be the impact on a nonprofit?
Well, a nonprofit isn't going to be impacted by these rules. So really, this is about profit-making entities that generate taxable income. So really, we're talking about some of the world's biggest multinational companies, you know, the Amazons, the Googles, and so on. So you have to be over a certain threshold in terms of your annual revenue for the tax to apply to you. So I think for the most part, this won't apply to nonprofits, but certainly, as you say, Jim, that's another area of concern, making sure that, you know, all organizations pay a reasonable share of tax. I think for nonprofit organizations, the situation is more complex, obviously, because they're working in the public good and they're not necessarily generating income or any profit. So, but it is important that their staff, for example, are subject to normal personal income tax regimes and the like.
So when you talk about the Amazons and the Googles of the world, if you will, how would closing these cross-border tax loopholes affect the tech world, affect tech companies?
Well, at some level, it will raise the cost of doing business, as Ivy mentioned earlier. Now, at this point, companies like Amazon and Google, these tech companies can often operate remotely, so they don't necessarily have a presence, a physical presence in a country where they have sales. And so as a result, they don't pay any tax there because in the past, you know, you only pay tax where you have a physical presence. And so by avoiding that, they are also able to avoid tax. So going forward under these new rules, that won't be possible. And they will be, you know, multinational companies will be subject to some level of tax everywhere that they operate or everywhere that they have business activity.
In our last couple moments together here, what obstacles do you see for finding international agreement on this really difficult issue?
Well, the fact that we've made it this far is very promising. That we can reach a political agreement on this is, yeah, as I said, unprecedented to see this level of international cooperation on taxation. However, there's a lot of details to be worked out. So as we discussed, many countries may begin to request exemptions or carve-outs. Of course, some countries didn't sign on to the deal, and that includes, for example, some low-tax European countries like Ireland,
which Estonia, will prove
Hungary. Problematic.
Yeah.
Exactly, prove problematic for getting an EU law passed, which is going to be important to implementing a global tax in Europe.
Alexandra, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Kate.
Alexandra Reedhead, she is with the International Institute for Sustainable Development, where she leads the Institute's research on tax-based erosion and profit shifting in mining. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.